After this break, we're going to be joined by one of the world's great violinists, who's last night kicked off an Irish tour. A lot more to the tour than just performing the concerts, however, and she'll explain all of that. Tasman Little has played with all the great orchestras as a soloist. She also directs orchestras such as the Norwegian Chamber, London Mozart Players, Royal Philharmonic, the Britain Symphonia, all sorts of people. She's worked with the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Simon Rattle, the whole bit. This is top-notch stuff here, top-notch. And after this break, we will have... And she's also got a rather spectacular violin, which I can't imagine it's the one she's going to bring in here, but apparently it is. Beautiful. And Tasman Little is with me in studio, as you just heard. Tasman, what was that piece you just played?
I just played the Lure from the E major Partita by Bach, which is one of the pieces that I'll be playing on my tour.
Now, this tour, Naked Violin, is billed as being interactive.
That's right.
What does that involve? Because it could mean anything.
It could indeed. What it really means is that, first of all, I introduce each piece in the programme. I talk a little bit about the piece and sometimes actually do some demonstrations, as I will in, for instance, the Paul Patterson, which opens the programme. What I also like to do during these Naked Violin concerts is invite the audience to participate by asking questions, because very often people have got something that they've always wanted to ask a violinist or a musician, and they never really got the opportunity. So this is their opportunity. So everybody out there, please, if you've got anything you've always wanted to know, then don't be shy. Do ask your question.
It doesn't necessarily mean that you can bring your own drum kit with you, your own violin, and join in.
Well, actually, recently I did a concert, and somebody had brought their daughter to come and hear me, and the daughter, who I think was about 6 years old, had brought her quarter-sized violin, which she proceeded to bring up to the platform, and in fact I did get it out and I did play a tiny bit on her quarter size violin, which went down rather well.
Well, you're asking for it.
I am, aren't I?
You are, very much. But there's a serious kind of philosophy on your part behind all of this. Obviously it's very entertaining to have a bit more action, because people often complain about classical concerts being dull, or at least people assume they are dull.
Yes.
And there's that assumption among young people in particular that
this
isn't a good night out. But so apart from the entertainment aspect, you have some serious thoughts about the whole issues of accessibility, and that's what the whole Naked Violin project is about.
That's very much the case, yes. What I wanted to do when I put the Naked Violin out, which was the download that I made available, which is still available on my website free of charge, what I wanted to do was to give people who had never had a chance to experience classical music for whatever reason the opportunity to do so. And in doing this free download, I put as wide a variety of repertoire as I could possibly think of out there, because not everybody does love Bach. I mean, I adore Bach, but it's not everybody's cup of tea, and some people find the Patterson an absolutely brilliant piece. For instance, I got a letter from a five-year-old boy in America saying, well, Bach is good, but Patterson is great. Patterson is buzz. Patterson is way gooder than Bach. You know, it was a fantastic letter. It was one of those really lovely letters that, you know,
And of course, that's all right, isn't it? It's all right not to like Bach.
It's all right, actually, not to like any of it. Mm. But what I really wanted to do was have at least give at least the opportunity to people to try it. And then if they listen, they say, well, it's not for me. Fair enough. You know, that I don't like rap very much. I love many different styles of music, but I just can't get on with rap. But there's tons of people out there who really love rap, and that's fine as well. So I think the only thing that I feel sad about is when people say, oh, classical music's not for me. And then if I say, well, have you listened to any? And they say no. Then I think, well, now that's the pity. At least try it and then decide.
So what was it for you, given that you went through the normal routine of studying classical music, performing in orchestras and so on, and the great orchestras, what was it for you that made you realize or think about this so carefully that you decided to do something about it? Where did you see the problems existing?
Well, many people have said to me over the years, people that I've met outside of classical music, you know, they have said, oh, I don't think it's for me. But also, I have got a bit fed up of politicians and various other people saying, oh, well, classical music is elitist. I mean, first of all, I think that's a complete misuse of the word, because something which is elite is actually the best. And there's no reason why classical music shouldn't be the best. What we actually mean, what people mean when they say elitist, is they say it's not accessible. And that's another matter. So the business of accessibility is something which I think is very important, and it should be accessible.
And where are the problems? Why isn't it accessible, in your view?
I think that there are any number of reasons, and they are different in different areas. One is that perhaps if you get a community which is quite a long way from anywhere geographically, it will be difficult to get live music to that place. There is, of course, a financial issue that it costs money to, for instance, put on a full symphony orchestra. You've got 80 mouths to feed and pay, and so therefore ticket prices have to be at a certain level, and we're not very good at subsidising the arts in the United Kingdom. You know, often you go to places like Germany and there's better funding from the government, so therefore they're able to keep ticket prices down, but ticket prices can be very high in the UK and hereabouts. Then I think that there's also the wider issue of what classical music actually means to people people. I mean, for many, many years, around about Beethoven's time, Mozart's time, classical music was the only kind of music that was popular music. However, earlier last century, gradually the idea of popular entertainment grew. And in a sense, that was where the division probably started. And it was music or it was classical music. And for me, that's a great pity because I don't think that there should be a division. But obviously, there was music that seemed to appeal to a larger number of people. And perhaps it's because it is more instantly digestible. There is one thing about classical music that sometimes you have to listen to a piece a few times before you can really get to grips with it. And even there are some pop songs that the first time you hear it, you think, I'm not quite sure what that's about. But then you hear it and it sort of catches you. But I think there are more classical pieces, and the length of a classical piece sometimes can, you know, be about 40 minutes. So, of course, you're not going to take all of that in on a first hearing. You need to stick with it. And then the other thing is, I've got two young children, and, you know, they both like listening to pop music. And I once asked my daughter, you know, what is it? And she said, I like that steady beat. And I think that's something that is very true for many people. They love the idea of a regular beat. It's something that unites a song, and in classical music you don't often get that.
Yeah, people want to dance.
Yes, people do. Yeah. But and yet, of course, the things you can dance in classical music as well. There's classical music is full of dances, and you know there are many waltzes in Tchaikovsky, for instance. You can dance to any one of them. But just this idea of this regular beat, and often 1, 2, 3, 4, people like that regularity.
I've read that in Beethoven's time and so on, that people went to the concerts and they hooped and they hollered, and if they didn't like something, they booed, and they clapped at certain bits they thought were great and reacted just as they would at a Bruce Springsteen concert. And the artists themselves would rearrange the program. They might only play one movement of a concerto or whatever it is, or one movement of a symphony, and then they throw in something else in the middle of it in case people were getting bored. So there was that element of popular entertainment at that time as well.
Absolutely,
wasn't there?
And we've become a bit fusty about the way that we imagine classical music should go. And I really laugh when people say, well, it's the authentic performance, because the authentic performance was very often as you described, with, for instance, the first performance of the Beethoven Violin Concerto given by Clement. He played the first movement, and then the orchestra went off and took a break. But Clement stayed, and he entertained the audience halfway through the piece by turning his violin upside down and doing a load of party tricks. Now, if we're talking about authentic performance, then heavens above, I think I've got some practice to do.
Because you see, I often think the problem with the accessibility issue with classical music, it's not the music itself, because the problem there is that people don't get to hear it, but once they do hear it, they tend to like it. But I think it's the scene. You know, it's not attractive to people who are used to going to rock concerts and used to going to clubs or used to going to jazz clubs or country and western clubs, whatever it is, going to a place where everybody's
sitting down,
yes. The lights are on,
absolutely,
and everybody, and you see people on the cover of records turned out in a rather peculiar way, looking like professors from the Open University in 1971. You know, it's not a very attractive scene. Now, not everybody falls into that, but I think a lot of young people think it's just, oh, what a dull bunch of people to hang around with.
Absolutely, and actually, I am the first person to say that I do think that classical music does need to be listened to. I don't like it as background music, and if I'm playing, I don't particularly want everybody talking through my performance. So that is one aspect that I feel very strongly about, because I think it quite often the music itself actually requires your concentration to follow it through. But I would say, from the other side, on the plus side, once you do, I think it's immensely rewarding. And I go into a lot of schools and work with children and play a variety of repertoire. And quite often I will ask them, in fact, always I will ask them what they think of it. And there are various adjectives that come up time and time again when they are describing their feelings listening to classical music. One is joyful, and I love that. That's one of my favourite ones. Another one is relaxing. And I think it's the fact that there is this absence of this boom, 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 boom. It does make you, I don't know, feel less stressed or something.
Yeah. But you don't want it to be a kind of a sedative either.
No, you shouldn't be falling
asleep.
Which
is often how classical music is approached on radio and television, isn't it? You know, or for some kind of fake sentiment. You know, here's the part in the movie where you have to feel sad, and we're going to tell
that's
you now
right,
by playing
yes.
some sad music.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah.
Now, another of the accessibility issues I wanted to raise with you is this. With some of the music, it must surely be the music's fault that there's an accessibility issue, because a lot of people hear music which even people who love it will describe as difficult.
Absolutely, and I couldn't agree more. There are many composers that I don't yet understand. Even with all my musical training, I can't follow what they were on about. But again, I don't think... This is the great beauty and the great problem of classical music. We have got 400 years worth of composers there. Now, you take your pick. You are bound to find some that are wonderful, and you're bound to find some that you just simply don't understand. It's a bit like a playwright or somebody writing a book. Mm. You know, you can love reading one particular author and another one who everybody else says, oh, this is great. You don't understand it. You don't get it. And that's fine. And that is absolutely fine. And that's why I believe very firmly that when you do a concert, you need to provide a variety of repertoire, because there's bound to be one piece that perhaps somebody will think, well, I kind of could have done without that one, but I really loved all the rest of it.
Well, let's talk about your repertoire then. The Bach we've heard a little bit of already. Most people like Bach, and most people from other musical disciplines like Bach. Jazz people tend to like Bach as well.
Yes.
And I spoke to a hip-hop artist once who loved Bach. You know,
he is the great-grandfather, really, isn't
of everything.
He? Of everything, yeah.
The Patterson piece, Paul Patterson, and you mentioned earlier about a kid liking Patterson.
Yes.
Not particularly well-known, I don't think.
No, not at all. Anyway. No, he's a British composer. He's just celebrated his 60th birthday. I think that he's a marvellous composer because I think he writes very approachably. And the Luslovica Variations that I'm going to be playing on the tour is a fantastic sort of any person's guide to the solo violin, because he wrote it for a violin competition. And so it was, in a sense, designed to put the violinists through their paces. So we've got all sorts of tricks that I'll be describing to the audience when I do my concerts, things such as left-hand pizzicato and saltando, where you drop the bow and you let it bounce, and pizzicato. Yes.
Well,
left-hand pizzicato. Well, pizzicato is when you pluck the string. But then, if I then bring my left hand into the plucking motion, you can set up a sound that will sound something like this. And then if you bring your bow into it, and so you are actually using the violin bow plus the left-hand pizzicato, you'll get something that sounds like this. So it's a combination of the bow plus the plucking at a rapid speed.
Wow.
Well, it's quite difficult, we'll put it that way. And then the saltando one is quite fun. It's literally, in fact, I quite often teach young violinists how to do this, because it's a great fun thing to be able to do. And it's literally when you place your bow kind of about an inch above the string, and you let it drop and it bounces because the hair is so springy on the bow. So you can do... You can just make a sort of really fun volley of notes, if you like.
You know, these techniques are used in bluegrass all the time. That's where that comes from. But that's so that piece will be wonderful for anybody who plays, and they will learn tricks.
Absolutely.
To amaze their friends.
But even if you are just a music lover and a listener, a lot of people have said to me afterwards, I loved the Patterson because I had no idea that the violin could produce such a wide range of sounds. And I think that's the thing, you know, people have got this idea that the violin sometimes sounds a bit like this when you're starting. You know, and obviously, hopefully, then you get beyond that stage. But people think of the violin as an instrument that produces a long line, which indeed it does. But it also can produce quite punchy sounds like this. So, you know, it can be quite sort of quite bouncy, quite boppy, if you like, and that's another bit from the.
I don't know how this sounds. Really, it's so great to be standing a foot away from you while you do that. So and then there'll be more Bach after the.
Yes.
The two pieces of Bach then.
The Patterson is the opening to the program, and then I'm going to play a sonata by Bach, which has a wonderful selection of movements. There's a slow movement, fast movement, slow movement, fast movement, and the second movement, which is called a fugue, is one of the great pieces of Bach, in my opinion. You know, Bach was a great organist, and lucky organists, they have two hands, 10 fingers, and 2 feet with all the pedals and everything, and And the idea of a fugue is that you've got a thought, an idea, and it gets passed through different lines. Only instead of having my feet and all my other fingers to work with, I just have four strings. But it's absolutely beautifully written. It's a very powerful piece as well.
And then the partita in E major.
That's right.
People know that one.
Yes, they do. And that's the one with the gavotte that I'll play at the end when we've finished talking.
Now, you're asking for trouble here, now I know. Now, I happen to like Béla Bartók, okay? But he's one of the people I'm thinking of that we mentioned earlier, that this can be difficult music, Bartók. And I know, yes, people who listen to my program say, well, just stop playing that Bartók. Because, you know, there comes a point and they think that's just a bit wild for me.
Yes. The very interesting thing about Bartók is that... on the one hand, he has this image of being a composer that you really have to work at to like. And yet there are some pieces that are so immediate and so incredibly enjoyable that I play them time and time again, particularly when I'm going into schools, as I do, into prisons, I go to many different areas of the community. And Bartók is the one composer that these people single out and they say, I liked the Bartók best. So it's very interesting. He went into the fields collecting folk songs that he heard, people singing in fields, you know, peasant workers. And so there is something that can be very immediate about this music as well. And the piece that I'm going to play in my program is the third movement from his solo sonata. And it's called very simply Melody. And what Bartók often does when he writes his slow music is that he is depicting night music. So in fact, this is an immensely restful piece with many transparent sounds. And he writes very cleverly using harmonics in order to create different sounds, such as a far-off bird or a cuckoo somewhere or the rustling of leaves. And he's creating sounds. I'll just demonstrate something of these harmonics. And it's really an incredible piece that builds up its own very special atmosphere in concert. And actually, I was in Northern Ireland at the beginning of this year, and I played at McGaffrey in the hospital wing for some of the prisoners there. And I was describing this piece beforehand, and your nurses were there listening as well. And there was complete silence at the end of it, and everybody absolutely loved it. And afterwards, this nurse came up to me. She said, oh, she said, I love that Bartók. She said, I closed my eyes, she said, and I was away with the fairies. So, I know exactly what you mean about Bartók having this terrible reputation, but actually some of his music can be incredibly powerful.
Now, the last composer, again, I don't know particularly well.
Eugene Isaie, that's right, Isaie. Yes. He was a great violinist, and so as you can imagine, he knew exactly how to get the most dramatic effects out of the violin. He wrote six works for solo violin, a little bit like Bach, and Isaie dedicated each of these solo sonatas to a great violinist. And the sonata number three, which is called Ballade, he dedicated to the great violinist Enescu, who was in fact Yehudi Menuhin's teacher, and Yehudi Menuhin, of course, taught me. Yeah. So I feel something of a line there, and that's possibly one reason why I like this piece so much. It's an incredibly virtuosic piece, and it leaves everybody gasping at the end, me included, because it's like a workout.
Yeah.
But it's a fantastic, again, very spirited piece. I'll just give you a little selection.
Don't hurt yourself.
No, I won't.
Thank you.
have to come to the concert to hear how it goes off after that.
Yeah, can we play that once a week, that one? Also?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually going to be playing it about 13 times in 14 days.
I want to ask you about that. This tour that you're doing in Ireland is a huge tour. Would you normally play that many dates at the same time?
Absolutely not. No. I have to say I'm going to be pacing myself for this tour because not only is it a great huge number of concerts in a very short space of time, but because of the intensity of the repertoire and the fact that I've got no pianist with me to share some of the load, yes, it's going to be exhausting. But I tell you something, you know, when I do these kinds of concerts where I've got the audience there and we're all, in a sense, we are the concert. It's not just me that's the concert. I get really fired up and I always find that even if I'm a little bit tired, I come and I do one of these concerts and the audience are so brilliant that we all just end up having lots of energy. We kind of share our energy and
it's... But it's not just the concert. I mean, you're going to do workshops as well.
I am indeed, and I'm very much looking forward to that. I love working with young people and seeing their enthusiasm and their energy and also just their feeling of love for the music and that they want to really work hard and get very good at their instruments. So I'm so looking forward to
this. Could you say that you have had better experiences, it's an unfair question maybe, better experiences playing in Belmarsh or a homeless hostel somewhere in Brighton or various places you've played, or playing in a school or doing a workshop, then you would have had playing with the Berlin Phil or you know, with a big orchestra or working with the greatest of people, which you have.
I'm very lucky. I've sort of reached all corners, as it were. And it's so incredibly exciting to play with a great orchestra like the Berlin Philharmonic and a wonderful conductor such as Simon Rattle. There's no doubt that I will look back, you know, when I'm old, and I will remember that as something that I'm so lucky to have done. But I have to say, in all honesty, ever since I started to go into the community and work with people really at grassroots level, I find that there's a lot that's developed in me and in my playing and just in my awareness of people, of their responses to music. I find it the most incredibly rewarding and worthwhile part of my life now, and I'm so glad that I began this project.
Well, I think it's great because, you know, we normally, if a musician of your stature shows up here, I could have begun with, oh, so tell me about Yehudi Menuhin and tell me about Sir Simon Rattle and tell me, you know, all that stuff, that, you know, the sort of high-end, spectacular, seriously impressive stuff. And yet we've been talking for the last half an hour about working with schools and so on.
Yes.
So I think it's greatly to your credit that this is what you do, because somehow it takes our eye off the ball a little about who you actually are. You know,
well,
in one way.
Yes, and I feel, you know, as a performer, I'm very, very lucky because I'm the vehicle, if you like. The composer wrote the amazing music, but obviously the music doesn't play itself. It needs someone to interpret it. It needs someone to bring it to life, and I love that job. And that's something that I feel very privileged to play, amazing music that's been written for the violin. But more importantly, I love the fact that I can bring it to life for people. I love their response for the music. And I am so aware that at the end of a concert or after I finish playing, the audience start to applaud and often cheer and sometimes stand up. I am very aware that a portion of that is for the composer as well, because I brought that composer to life. And so it's, you know, it's teamwork, isn't it?
Yeah, but you'll also have changed people's lives, you know? You know,
it
and you
do,
will probably have changed more lives in the schoolroom then you will change in the concert hall.
And not just in the schoolroom, you know, because I had letters from all over the world when I began the Naked Violin Project and the download went live. I had a lovely letter from a guy from the United States who described himself as an aging 50s rock and roller. And he wrote and he said, I have always loved rock and roll. I never thought classical music was for me. But now I've listened to the Naked Violin, he said, it makes me want to throw away all my rock and roll records and just listen. Exactly. And I wrote back as quickly as I could, please don't throw away. You know, this is not an either or situation. Now you can enjoy both.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the important thing, really, isn't it? And aren't we just so incredibly lucky that we now live in a time where people can have that access, where I can put a recording of solo violin music made in England, and somebody in the middle of Africa or in the middle of China can access that. It's just astonishing.
I mean, that's a whole area we probably should have talked about, the free download scenario, because it's a big issue in rock music, obviously. Radiohead did their thing, you pay what you like for the record and
yes.
so on. Did that cause any problems for you business-wise with the people you work with your agent, with your publishers and so on? Did they, you know, oh, you shouldn't be doing this, you know?
Actually, there was remarkably little negative feedback that I got, because I made it very clear when I began the download that this was about introducing people to something that they might not have had an opportunity to do so. And because I didn't concentrate just on one area of repertoire, for instance, putting out all the six solo Bach works, it wasn't like I was actually providing something that you could go and buy in a record shop anyway. Yeah. And so I was hoping that if people decided that they really liked the Bach, they would go into a record shop and buy a whole disc of Bach. So, I mean, in a way, yeah. I was very much hoping that what I would do would complement what everybody else is already doing and doing very successfully. But also the idea is to get people into the concert hall, because, you know, at the end of the day, live music is where it's at. I mean, of course, I've made CDs. I sell CDs. That's fantastic. And for people that can't get out, that's a wonderful, wonderful way that you can access classical music. But at the end of the day, for me, it's always the live performance that is the greatest one, because that's the one where the risk takes place. It's the one where it's happening right in front of you. But more crucially, it's the one where everybody's in the room together and you're all concentrating on that one thing.
Well, Tasman, thank you very much for coming in. Thanks for coming to Ireland and doing such an extensive tour. I'll give the dates of the tour after. I hope you're going to play another piece of music for us. By the way, is that the violin?
That's my 1757 Guadagnini. It's made the year after Mozart was born, and it's a stunning instrument. As you can see, it's got a ton of red varnish, all these red flames up the back. It's a beautiful instrument, and I think it's going to work really well in all the venues that I'm going to be playing. It's got this beautiful, rich, creamy sound that I really love.
I thought you might leave that one at home and take another one to Mullingar, wherever you're going.
No, I brought the best.
Thank you, Tasman. And what are you going to play for us now? Another piece of Bach?
Yes, I'd like to close with a lovely, fun piece of Bach. It's the Gavotte in the form of a rondo.
check out our website, rte.ie/lyricfm/JK.